If I can't crystallize what's in my head onto paper in a clear thesis statement, then maybe I don't understand it as well as I thought I did, or maybe my conviction is not as high as it should be. And then in that third week when I'm waiting to speak to management, I'm also probably bouncing the ideas off of other investors that I respect.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. And today, we have the pleasure of being joined by John Rotondi. John is the portfolio manager of the industrial and infrastructure strategy at Isla Mirada Investment Management. Prior to Isla Mirada, John spent nearly a decade at the Motley Fool, where among other roles, he served as the head of investor training and development. I've known John for quite a while, and I can personally say that he is an exceptional teacher of long-term fundamental-focused investing and a true perpetual learner when it comes to businesses and markets broadly. With that, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ryan. I'm excited to talk about investing today.
All right. Before we get into sort of your process, your strategy, everything that goes into that, let's get the sort of the thumbnails on your career. I guess, why did you get into the investment world? And was there a point when you knew this is what you wanted to do for the rest of your life?
Yep. The answer to both those questions is the same. I found out when I was a freshman in college that my parents had gotten into financial trouble and they were paying for my college tuition. And so I felt guilty. I felt obligated to do something. So I went to the library and started trying to learn about money. And that led me to stocks and that led me to the stock market. And I started reading. And eventually I read Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. And that's the book that changed my life. And that's the moment I knew I wanted to do this for a living. I don't remember if I was 18 or 19, but I was a freshman in college, and that book set off two light bulbs in my head, or two epiphanies. One was that I understand the stuff he's talking about. You know, when he didn't get deep into the math of investing, but things like debt to equity ratios, PE ratios, PEG ratios, returns on equity, I understood it all. So the first epiphany was, I can do this. I have confidence I can do this. And the second epiphany was, I think I would love doing this, and this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I've not stopped studying about businesses or markets or economies and how they all interrelate since then.
Okay, so you mentioned Peter Lynch there. Who are some of your other investing role models?
Definitely, you know, Peter Lynch set me on the path that I'm on today. I eventually, you know, I don't know if it was my freshman year or my sophomore year, but there during college, I eventually made my way over to Warren Buffett. And, you know, like most people, read everything I could get my hands on that he had written or that was written about him. So, you know, I would say to answer this question, definitely Buffett and Munger. That's almost a given. Anyone that was on The J. Rowe Show, which was my podcast that I had after leaving The Motley Fool before I joined Isla Mirada Investment Management. So any of those people, I didn't put anyone on that show because I was trying to fill a slot. Every single one of those guests I reached out to personally because I admired the heck out of them as investors and as people. So any of those people on the show, I think based on what I know, that next to Warren Buffett, Stanley Druckenmiller is arguably the best investor alive. I don't invest like him. He's got a much broader tool set than me, much broader. And he's got much more experience. But if the numbers are right, if he's 30% annualized over 30 years with never a down year, that's hard to beat. That's hard to top. And every time I listen to an interview, he's been doing more interviews lately, thank goodness. every time I listen to one of his interviews, I learn something, but also I realize every single time that he does an interview that he's just playing at a different level than I am, honestly, at a much, much higher level. He's in a different, you know, stratosphere, different galaxy. The way that he combines his, you know, 30 or 40 years of market experience, which is huge. You cannot get that unless you've lived it. You know, you have to experience the emotions of up and down markets, and you have to internalize the lessons that you learn from making mistakes over time. So you cannot replace experience. But, you know, the combination of his experience with how he has a tool set that includes fundamental investing, momentum, technical, macro, long, short, you know, derivatives, you name it. His tool set is much broader than mine. So I would say Druck, sidecar cap on X, on Twitter, and his focus on owner operators, and, you know, companies that are really sort of in that emerging moat stage in a lot of cases, and his ability to both identify great owner operators and companies with emerging moats. He's definitely on there. David Gardner, you know, David Gardner has a unique investing philosophy. It's different from a lot of other growth investors. He developed it entirely on his own over years of experience and living in markets and recommending 3 stocks every single month. He's not doing it anymore, but, you know, he was doing 2 Rule Breaker and 1 Stock Advisor stocks every month. And, you know, when you put in those reps, you get really, really good. Jeff Fisher, who is on Twitter now, I think of Jeff Fisher as he's identifying David Gardner-like stocks, but using more of a traditional valuation lens as well. And the way that he combines the two is pretty remarkable. I would give my money to Jeff, you know, tomorrow to manage, as I would everyone else that I've just mentioned on this list. But then Jeff is also an expert with options. And so he's got a toolkit that I love watching and learning from as well. Samantha McLemore, you know, I didn't have the chance to interview her on the J. Rose show because I shut it down when I took my new job, but she was high on the list of people that I wanted. If, you know, she 20 years was under Bill Miller. So she, you know, had one of the greatest investing mentors of all time. And, you know, if I was thinking about an asset management firm as I do a business, like a stock, and, you know, I think of Samantha as having the potentially the most upside to like my earnings estimates or something. Like, I really think that she inherited a portfolio that was strong, that she is putting her own personal touches on, her and her team. And the portfolio has changed significantly since she took it over, I think 2 or 3 years ago. Her ability to combine, you know, traditional deep value investing with also growthier stocks using a sort of reverse DCF method to see what's priced into it. And so she invests across that growth spectrum. I think her returns are really going to surprise to the upside. There's no secret Bill Nygren is a friend of mine and someone that I admire deeply. Last two I'll mention, Joel Tillinghast. We started off talking about Peter Lynch. Joel was interviewed by, hired by, trained by, mentored by, and worked under Peter Lynch at Fidelity. I still think Joel has the single sentence greatest stock picking quote I've ever come across, which is, crisply put, you want low PE stocks that are also high quality and growing with a high degree of certainty about the long-term outlook. It's really hard to beat that one sentence when it comes to stock picking. And the last one I'll say is David Einhorn. I love his writing. I love his thinking. I love his book. And his thesis on how markets are not properly valuing companies anymore, at least not in a timely fashion. And so he chooses to no longer rely on the market to re-rate these stocks to the higher multiple that they deserve in a timely manner. And so he has largely switched his strategy towards a current cash flow return strategy, or a shareholder shareholder yield strategy where he wants the company to be returning cash. He wants the, if the market's not going to re-rate the stock and buy the stock from him, he wants the company to buy the stock from him through buybacks or through very large dividends or a return that way or through a very high yielding debt instrument. So he's doing something a little different there that is very interesting with shareholder yield.
Yeah, looking across at all the names you just mentioned, it just goes to show how there are more than one way to win in the market because Absolutely. Pretty much all of them have very different strategies. Let's focus a bit on your portfolio. You have now officially launched the industrial and infrastructure portfolio for Isla Mirada Investment Management this month. What's the goal of the portfolio? And I guess, what's sort of the mandate? What types of companies can you own? Is it sort of a long-only focus? How many companies are you expecting to own in it? All that stuff.
So it's a long-only, domestic-only. And by domestic, we mean report in U.S. dollars and trade on a U.S. stock exchange. Long-only, domestic-only, 20 to 40 stock, high-quality industrials, infrastructure, and housing-related portfolio. I currently have 32 stocks. As you said, I launched on Thursday, January 23rd. And, you know, I consider these to be among the highest quality, profitable, growing, owner-operated businesses that I've ever come across. And that's the mandate, to only invest only. I mean, this if there is a mandate, it's to not sacrifice quality of the business and quality of the management team. That's my line in the sand. And, you know, I try to buy them when they are fairly or preferably deeply undervalued. I'm not finding a lot of deep undervaluation today. And so I'm buying a lot of companies at fair value, but the quality, I believe the quality of the business and the duration or the runway of per share growth is what I'm most attracted to. The rate of growth is less important to the portfolio than the duration of per share growth, because that's really when compounding is most powerful. And what my goal is to try to beat the market after expenses over rolling 5-year periods.
Okay, let's talk process. So you're looking for durable, growing, high-quality businesses at reasonable or hopefully attractive prices. How do you get to that? So let's say a new idea comes across your desk. Where do you start your research process? And what is the life cycle from there, from idea generation to ultimately potentially being included in your portfolio?
Idea generation. So let me just say that most of my ideas are likely going to come from something I already own, buying more of something I already own, or from my watch list. So I have right now 32 stocks in the portfolio, and let's say 30 stocks that I would love to have in the portfolio and I'm ready to buy at a moment's notice because I've done the research on them. So I would say that most of my new ideas for the portfolio will come from that watch list where the research is already done. But let's, you know, the second thing I'll say about new idea generation is I don't find new ideas often. I've created a process, which we're going to get into, where I'm kicking out 90%, maybe 95% of every idea that I come across within an hour and sometimes within 10 minutes. So I'm saying no to almost everything because they don't meet the quality criteria, quality of management, quality of the business, duration of growth, or the valuation. For something will trigger me within 10 minutes to an hour, it gets kicked out. In the last, I would say 5 years, Ryan, I've probably only found 1 to 3 new ideas a year, honestly. So I'm not finding a lot of new ideas, but I'm excited when I do. And so the process looks like this. You know, I would say that I can get, you know, 15 to 25% of the research done in a day or two. Honestly, I know that's going to blow some minds. People claim, you know, you don't understand a business. You're not ready to invest in a business unless you've researched it for 6 months or a year or something like that, or you followed it for multiple years. Sometimes that's the case because I'm waiting on valuation, but I think I can understand. I can get 15 to 25% of the way done in a day or two by reading the proxy, the 10K, the most recent earnings call, the most recent year-end earnings call. If there's a recent investor day and slide deck, the transcript and the slide deck, and then diving into the numbers. And I say that takes me 1 to 2 days because if it's a smaller company with one division of business, the 10K may only be 60 or 70 pages. You know, if it's a larger company with three or four different divisions, the 10K may be 200 or 300 pages. And so some of these documents are longer. Some of these earnings calls are longer. Whatever. Sometimes the numbers are a little bit more complicated. But within 1 to 2 days, I've done that. I've read the 10K. I've read the proxy. I've read most recent earnings call, most recent year-end earnings call, and the investor day transcript, if there's one, and dive into the numbers. And then, you know, the rest of that week, the other 5 or 6 days in that week, is pretty much just me reading earnings calls. So more earnings calls going further back. And then maybe expert transcript calls from something like Tegas or AlphaSense now. AlphaSense has acquired Tegas. Reading about it on Twitter. If there's some good write-ups or thoughts on Twitter, maybe reading about it in other newsletters, Substacks, and yeah, that's probably the rest of that week. That's one week. And then the second week is like trying to read more about the industry, really. It's usually how I go. So industry journals, trying to get growth rates on the industry, expected growth rates on the industry from companies like Gartner, or, you know, there's different companies like that, Forrester, eMarketer, reading sell-side research. That's usually if, you know, we have access to sell-side research, I'll usually do that in the second week, especially like initiation reports or recent, you know, industry reports that are in longer form. And then that's the second week, and I'm usually almost done. The third week, the whole time I'm preparing questions for management, the whole time, from the first minute of the first day through the 2 weeks that I just described. And, you know, a lot of times I'm answering those questions myself as I go along and learn more. But the ones that are unanswered, usually in that third week, I will try to speak to management if it's not a quiet period during earnings. During that third week, I will write up my thesis, like a 1 or 2 pager. I find that writing really helps me flush out the thesis and the conviction. If I can't crystallize what's in my head onto paper in a clear thesis statement, then maybe I don't understand it as well as I thought I did, or maybe my conviction is not as high as it should be. And then in that third week when I'm waiting to speak to management, I'm also probably bouncing the ideas off of other investors that I respect.
I like that. So,
and I'm working on valuation in that third week. So that's like a 3-week process.
That makes sense. So we just talked about after you've come across something that's, you know, potentially captivating, you've kind of worked through your checklist, tried to disqualify things. Before that, where are you generating some of these ideas? Does it change each time, or are you someone that focuses a lot on screeners, or are you kind of more so catching ideas through your network?
Yeah, so most of my ideas are high quality, profitable growth businesses, well-managed, expertly managed businesses that I've been covering for a while and admiring for a while. So this watch list has been with me for a long time. Most of it's coming from the watch list. But when there is a new idea, I would say that they come from my network. I would say they come from reading investor letters, looking at 13Fs, you know, especially new positions, especially new large positions, or especially new big additions to existing positions. You know, if it's a, you know, 50 basis point position in the tail end of the portfolio and the portfolio owns 80 stocks, that means nothing to me. Absolutely nothing. So 13Fs, investor letters, investor network, studying competitors of businesses that I already own or are on the watch list. Very little screening. Those are, you know, battleground stocks are a good way to get ideas because they're mispriced one way or the other, usually, either too high or too low. And so when there's a big discrepancy between Wall Street estimates for earnings, in the next 2 or 3 years, and for the stock price, 12-month or 24-month forward stock price from Wall Street, when there's big, huge discrepancies, really wide ranges, that I'm just interested. And so I'll dive in and see kind of where I land on that spectrum. So yeah, Battleground stocks is one place. And then I would say, although I'm not a thematic investor, I'm also not a 100% pure bottoms up investor. By the way, bottoms up means that an investor does not look at themes or long duration secular trends at all. They don't pick which industries or verticals or sectors they look at based on that. Rather, they just look at stocks. And if they are finding that most of the stocks that are undervalued are all in the same industry, then that's the industry they are attracted to. So if hypothetically, if they're finding most of the cheap stuff is in financials, right? Then they're interested in banks and financials and financial services. Or if all the high free cash flow yields are in energy, then they're most interested in energy. But they're not finding energy because of some long-term theme or some supply-demand dynamic that way. I kind of combine it. I'm more flexible. Sometimes I find something, a stock that I just think is cheap. Other times I'm really attracted to a long duration, secular, hurricane force tailwind. And then I will start looking at businesses in that industry. Long duration, growth drivers can bail you out of a lot of things. If the business is powered by these long-term trends, it's more likely that the organic revenue growth rate can be sustainable for a long period of time. If the business is powered by these long duration trends, it's also more likely that organic revenue growth could accelerate and possibly surprise to the upside. If a business is powered by these long duration trends, it's unlikely that in the near term, the business will miss revenue or see decelerating revenue to the downside. And so when you have these powerful tailwinds, it's just more likely that the business can sustain organic revenue growth for a long period of time. And as we've hopefully driven the point home, I'm really focused on long duration growth, and then and particularly on a per share level. And so one trend in the portfolio is the electrical grid and the electrification of everything. And so Goldman Sachs has estimated that the current grid in the US is 50 to 70 years old, and that it would take 40 years to replace 50% of the current grid, and 80 years to replace 100% of the current grid. And Goldman estimates, and they're using industry level data coming from utilities, coming from watchdogs in the utility space to come up with these numbers. Goldman's estimate is going to cost, it's going to require $4.1 trillion of transmission and distribution, or T&D, CapEx through 2045. And my research has also led me, I don't think there's a phrase that I've tweeted out more over the last 2.5 or 3 years than the electrification of everything. This is a long-term secular growth trend that I believe strongly in. And so, the Ilam Rada infrastructure, industrials and infrastructure portfolio is heavily invested in this grid trend, this electrification of everything trend. And let's say Goldman's wrong, and it's not $4.1 trillion in CapEx that needs to be spent through, the next 20 years. Let's say it's $2 trillion. Half of that, my companies are going to do just fine. That $4 trillion number is a massive number. If it's just half, my companies are going to do just fine, in my opinion, based on my analysis. Another trend with a $4 trillion number, by the way, is, Jensen, CEO of NVIDIA, said that he expects data center CapEx is $4 trillion of data center CapEx is necessary over the next 4 to 5 years. That's another $4 trillion number. Let's say Jensen's wrong and it's $2 trillion. I think my AI infrastructure related names are going to be just fine. So these are really big, powerful hurricane force tailwinds that I'm interested in. So I do find stocks that way. I find a trend that I have high conviction in. Last one I'll say is, you know, when Warren Buffett bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe, the railroad, he gave his reasoning on a CNBC interview with Becky Quick. And he said, you know, we've found a business that we believe is going to be dominating in 100 or 200 years that is also intertwined and crucial to the U.S. economy. That's what I'm looking for. Now, it's hard to find a business that I have high conviction will be in a dominant position in 100 years. It's almost impossible, but a railroad is one of them. A railroad is one of them, and we have a railroad in the portfolio. Railroads are cheaper than trucks. I have nothing against high-quality trucking companies, but railroads are, you know, 10 to 20% cheaper than trucks and four times more energy efficient. They release four times less carbon into the atmosphere. So it's the most efficient way to move GDP in the U.S.
What are some of your deal breakers? So what are some of the characteristics of a business that disqualify it from ever entering the portfolio, or maybe never say never, but it disqualifies it for you?
I mean, low quality is my deal breaker. And I said, that's the line in the sand. I'm not going to sacrifice quality in this portfolio. And there's different ways of defining low quality based on the business, based on the industry. But at a high level, if I think the business is facing long-term headwinds, if I think the industry is facing long-term headwinds instead of tailwinds, if I think the competitive position of the business, I don't even want to call it a moat because at this point they don't have a moat, but if I think that is deteriorating, if I think its competitive position in the industry is getting weaker, not stronger, if the fundamentals have been deteriorating for a while, I'm not just talking about one bad quarter, but you see sort of multiple years of declining revenue growth, declining revenue, you know, revenue is actually declining, margins are falling, returns on invested capital are falling. Management is another deal breaker for me is if management is buying back stock when these things are happening. The last thing you ever want to see a manager do is buy back stock. I don't care what the multiple is. I don't care if the multiple is one. Okay. If it's buying back stock in a business with a deteriorating competitive position, with a business facing massive headwinds, with a business facing deteriorating fundamentals and deteriorating moat. So if a manager like we saw that at like Best Buy, not Best Buy, Bed Bath & Beyond, not Best Buy. That is an awful, awful thing to see. It was sad what that management team was doing at Best Buy. And then if the company is unprofitable and I don't think it's going to be profitable in the next year, that's a pretty hard line for me. And then if the company is just diluting shareholders and they just don't have this owner mentality, if I don't find that owner mentality from the management team and the board, and if they're not economically aligned with outside shareholders, then I'm just not interested.
Do you think you spend more time on maintenance coverage or new idea generation?
Definitely. I don't have an analyst right now. And so definitely, and I have 32 stocks in the portfolio. So definitely maintenance coverage. I'm watching my basket very, very closely. I'm trying to understand these businesses really well, and I'm trying to have a very comfortable, high conviction thesis around the valuation and what I think expected returns are going forward. So definitely maintenance coverage. Like I said, you know, I'm always sifting through new ideas, but like I said, that just ends up, I'm just kicking them out. I'm just saying no to everything. I'm not always. So the way it works is, during earnings season, it's just all earnings. It's just all maintenance coverage. In between earnings season, I'll start to look for new ideas. I'm still reading about existing holdings. I'm still learning about existing holdings all the time. But it's in between earnings when I start to look for new ideas. But then it's that process we talked about. I'm just kicking everything out, saying no to everything, whittling away and away and away just to leave myself with the highest quality basket of positions and of watch list names that I can find. So definitely spend more time on maintenance.
Okay, let's jump into some of the lessons you've learned over your career. I want to talk, I guess, about one of your great investments and one of your worst investments. Let's start with worst. What's an investment you've made that did not work out the way you wanted? And what did you learn from that investment?
So I had an early investment in Research in Motion, BlackBerry. And I bought this stock when it had $2 billion in net cash, and it was generating $2 billion a year in free cash flow, thereabouts, if I remember correctly. And I bought it when the very first iPhone came out. Very first iPhone. So, I don't remember, 2014, maybe? I don't remember when the first iPhone came out, but that's when I bought the stock. And obviously, Research in Motion stock was selling off because of the iPhone. It was this revolutionary, we thought at the time, product. It had no keyboard, no type pad. And I bought the stock, and when I thought it was cheap, because it had sold off a lot, like I said, it had net cash, so X cash was trading at single-digit multiples. It was still generating free cash flow at the time, and a lot of it. And I had this thesis that I loved my BlackBerries so much, I didn't think people were going to want to get rid of the type pad. There were some other things at the time, like there was this other idea out there at the time. Remember, this is a decade ago, that BlackBerry had the safest platform from a cybersecurity standpoint. And, you know, I thought that was important. Anyway, the stock continued to get crushed because the iPhone became a just game-changing product. It became the most important consumer product, arguably of all time, definitely the most profitable consumer product of all time. And, you know, I think I finally sold after the stock had fallen like 50 or 60%. And the lesson was I bought this stock in BlackBerry without ever touching an iPhone at the time. I didn't have an iPhone. I didn't go to a store to hold an iPhone, to play with an iPhone, to see how truly revolutionary and innovative it was. I didn't, you know, I think one of my sisters had got the early iPhone, and so I could have just played with hers and she could have showed me how it works. I didn't do any of that. And so I didn't actually try the product. I didn't do that scuttlebutt. I didn't do that, you know, hit the streets and see what people are saying about this new product. I never put it in my hand. And so that was the lesson, especially with consumer-facing names, is, you know, try it out, you know, feel it. You know, and that's Peter Lynch. He talks about this, in, as you know, in One Up on Wall Street, you know. If you like a coffee shop, go to the coffee shop, see how long the lines are, all of those things. See what people are saying about it online. Talk to the customers as they're waiting in line. See what their thoughts are. Just try to get a feel for the product and the joy that product brings to people. And I didn't do any of that with the iPhone when I was invested in BlackBerry.
Okay, let's invert the question. What is an investment that surprised to the upside for you? In other words, a business that exceeded your expectations, and what did you learn from it?
The answer is every single stock that I've ever bought a 1% position of that ended up 10 bagging or more. I mean, if you think about it, you know, people can own it. By the way, I've owned a lot of stocks that are not 10 baggers. I've owned a lot of stocks that have gone down 50, 60, 70%. But if you think about it, you know, someone buys a 10 bagger or a 100 bagger, and then they tell you, I knew it was going to go up 10 or 100 times. No, you didn't. You would have bought more than 1% or more than 50 basis points, right? Like, this is something Jim Mueller, someone that I know you know, had drilled into me like a decade ago. He's like, if you really knew, if you really had conviction at least, then you would have bought more than a toe dip, right? You wouldn't have just dipped a toe. And so I've got a lot of these where I just bought a 1% position. Early on, I didn't have a lot of money to invest. So, you know, I put $1,000 in something, it goes up 10x, it's only $10,000. That's not really game-changing money. It's a 10x, but like, it's not really game-changing money. I've got a lot of those, Ryan. So there's a long list. But, you know, Tesla, I bought Tesla at the perfect time. It just didn't size it correctly. I bought a 1% position. So it was 2018, I think. And this was when Elon Musk said that he was literally sleeping on the factory floor. That was a quote. Two other quotes that he said in 2018 were, he said this after 2018, looking back at 2018. But after 2018, he said, we were about a month from bankruptcy. also speaking of that time in 2018 when he was sleeping on the factory floor, he said, and this is a quote too, "We were single digit weeks away from collapse." And so you can Google those quotes. But what I saw was you had a CEO that was sleeping on the factory floor, not for a night, this was for like 3 weeks or something, sleeping on the factory floor, that if you look at all of the metrics, so they weren't profitable, but like their net income margins had gone from like negative 20% 3 years prior to 2018 to like negative 2%. And they were consistently getting better. The losses were consistently decreasing. Same with free cash flow margins. They were almost break even in free cash flow at the time. Not quite, but almost. Same with returns on invested capital, returns on equity. As I just said net income, but so that would imply that. But they were almost break even at their returns. And they were scaling up the Model 3, which was like this really important car at the time. And so everything lined up. And, you know, it dramatically surprised to the upside. I didn't think it was going to do as well as it did since then. If I did, as I said, I would have taken a much larger position. But it dramatically surprised to the upside. It scaled much faster than I thought. Now, 2024 was a rough year for Tesla. But, you know, I'm talking about from 2018 to now. 2024 was a rough year for the auto business at Tesla, at least. But the business scaled dramatically faster than I thought. It turned out to be dramatically more profitable than I thought, with higher returns on invested capital, more net cash, and now much more optionality. Because you look at, first of all, the energy and storage business is a fantastic business. Absolutely critical to the grid thesis that we just talked about. $4 trillion in spending on T&D through 2045. It's an estimate from Goldman Sachs, but you know, $4 trillion in spending. Goldman Sachs also estimates it's going to take 40 years to replace half the grid. So the energy and storage business there is a tremendous business, high margin business that is being powered by this long-term trend of electrification of everything. But then you've got FSD, you've got eventually, you've got the, you know, self-driving taxi business, and then you've got the humanoid business, the robot business. So there's a lot more optionality upside now than there was then. I mean, what did I learn when I think I found a perfect setup like that? Because it was perfect in 2018, run by a arguably one of a kind. I mean, Elon's probably the closest thing we have to an alien. You know, just true brain power, but also the ability to get things done, to turn his visions into reality. Yeah, the lesson is size it better, size it up appropriately.
I like that. Yeah, I guess to maybe reposition the question a little bit, off the top of your mind, do you have any companies, any businesses, any investments that you did size appropriately? You thought it was, you made it a large position and it actually worked out exactly how you thought it would?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm pretty good at this, but yeah, like Alphabet was trading at 15 times earnings at one point in time in 2014. And, you know, I remember at the Motley Fool sitting down with an analyst, Liz Hall, and we did the valuation together on Alphabet and we came to the conclusion that this thing was dirt cheap for arguably the best business on earth at the time. And I bought a lot of it. And since then I have bought more, you know, over the years. Same with Visa. At one point you could buy Visa, and I did, at 15 times earnings. You know, now it's 30 or now it's 27 or something like that, multiple. And then, I mean, there's others. I bought Microsoft and Apple when they were trading at 10 times earnings, 10 times free cash flow. You know, when you can find, doesn't happen often, when you can find a business with the moat of an Apple or a Microsoft at 10 times earnings, 10% free cash flow yield, that's in my opinion, a table banger. And so there have been times when I have sized things correctly, yes.
Yeah, it's a great example of the benefits of having a robust coverage universe that you keep up with and research well, but the patience to wait for the right price. You mentioned Google, Visa at 15 times earnings. I never even realized it traded that low.
Very briefly. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, it allows you to be aggressive when the time is right. Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs this show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically, so head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Let's shift gears a little bit to, I guess, valuation discussion. You recently sent out a memo highlighting some of your thoughts on valuation, and I'm going to read a quote here. You said, "I would very rarely, and once again, probably never, base a thesis on thinking an extremely rich multiple gets ever more rich. Multiple contraction can act as a pretty severe headwind to returns." I'm kind of paraphrasing here and skipping some, but it says, "I would only buy the stock here if my research led me to believe that it could grow earnings per share fast enough to offset price to earnings multiple contraction." I guess my question to you is, do you ever include multiple expansion as a part of your thesis?
Not my base case, but I spend a lot of time thinking about what the right multiple is. And that, you know, comes from primarily, I try to calculate what I think a justified PE is. And Michael Mobison has put out a paper on this. He actually put out a matrix. And, you know, warranted or justified PEs are driven by three numbers: return on incremental invested capital, earnings growth, and the riskiness of the business, which flows through its cost of capital. And there's, you know, he's put out a matrix and a paper where you have return on incremental invested capital on one axis and earnings growth on another axis, and you assume like a 10% cost of capital and what the fair PE is, what the justified PE is. So I do that for all my businesses. That's one way I think about what the PE should be. I also look at, you know, a carefully selected group of peers, what their average multiple is, what they have traded at historically, what the company has traded at historically, all these different things. But I do spend a lot of time thinking about multiples. And the way I think about it is, you know, I have like a, I think we've discussed before, I come up with a range of growth estimates for per share growth, 10 to 15% or, you know, 16 to 20% or 20% plus. And, you know, and I come up with sort of a range of valuation estimates based on like a bear case, a base case, and a bull case. The bull case in some, when I think it's appropriate, may include multiple expansion. Yes, the bull case. But I never buy based on the bull case. I'm always buying when I think something is cheap based on the base case or the bear case. And so there are opportunities when I think the multiple absolutely should expand because the company has returns on invested capital that I think are going to be higher in the future than they are today, or because I think organic revenue growth is going to accelerate, or because I think per share earnings per share growth is going to accelerate, or that I think it's going to maintain its current levels longer than the market expects. Or because I think the market is getting something dramatically wrong about the risk profile and that it should have a much lower cost of capital than the market is giving it. So there are definitely times when I think the multiple should expand. That's not the reason I buy. And so that if it does happen, that ends up being optionality upside. It's just the returns, if the company ends up growing as fast as I thought it would, and the multiple ends up expanding, and you get that twin engine effect, that twin turbo engine effect of earnings per share growth and PE multiple expansion. If that happens, it ends up just being the icing on the cake when I get that PE multiple expansion. So yes, I think about it, but I don't buy based on it. Not normally. There was a time, you know, home builders, there's always exceptions. I don't want to have fast and hard rules because then that eliminates too many ideas. You know, home builders in 2022 were trading at 4x earnings. It's ridiculous. And so, yeah, you know, I thought there was going to be some multiple expansion there, and I purchased some home builders on the thesis that the multiple would expand. Yes, but it's rare when I do so.
Okay. Let's talk about two other businesses that you've written up recently. And I guess I should plug your newsletter here. I've been enjoying your recent thoughts. And two of the companies you wrote about were Amphenol and Trane Technologies. Both of these seem like high quality businesses, but I would say they also trade at sort of optically expensive multiples, around 30 times trailing earnings. How do you think about the valuation for these two businesses? And I guess maybe in general, when you've got a business that you really like, but maybe you think the valuation is a little expensive at first glance, I guess, how do you deal with situations like that? And then quick plug, where can anyone find your newsletter?
Thank you so much for mentioning the newsletter, for reading the newsletter. And I know you read them because you've emailed me being like, hey, I like the Amphenol write-up. I like the Trane write-up. I really appreciate that. Yeah, you can go to lastbastion.com. And there's literally a button in the top right-hand corner that says subscribe. And then you can subscribe to J. Rose Notes if you want. And I've only put out three so far, three newsletters. I'm doing one a week right now. The first one was on valuation, and you just quoted from that one. And the second two were my earnings updates on Amphenol and Trane Technologies. You know, full disclosure, these are companies in the industrials and infrastructure portfolio. And, you know, just so people know, when they're, these are my earnings updates. They're not a deep dive. They're not a buy recommendation. They're not a thesis write-up. These are my earnings updates. But I just want to quickly mention, while we're plugging my newsletter, I've gotten some DMs and emails from people that really like the format. And so I give, like, you know, three or four short paragraphs on how the company performed and my thoughts on their performance. And then what I do is I pick out the most important quotes that I think from the earnings call, and I attach those to the bottom of the newsletter, but I also bolt what sentences or what lines or what phrases from those quotes from the earnings calls are most meaningful to me in how I analyze businesses. And people are really appreciating that because they're sort of getting a glimpse. Not that everyone wants this glimpse, but the people that do, into how my investing mind works. By bolding things, they're seeing what sticks out to me. And then I do the same thing after those quotes that I bold. I include, you know, four or five slides from the slide deck, from the earnings presentation slide deck. And sometimes on the slide decks, I'm also highlighting and bolding what stands out to me. And so my clients in particular really, really appreciate that, that I'm not just sharing the quotes, but I'm bolding the phrases and sentences that are most meaningful to the way that I do business analysis. So you asked about valuation. So it's true that Amphenol and Trane, ticker APH and TT, they both currently trade at a next 12 month PE of, you know, 25 to 30. So two things I'll say is those multiples drop down to a market multiple. The market's currently at 22. So those multiples drop down to a market multiple in 3 or 4 years, which one sort of general heuristic that I use is if I'm going to pay an above market multiple, once again, the S&P is currently at 22 times forward. If I'm going to pay an above market multiple, one, it has to be for a far above average business, which I believe these two to be. But the other thing is I have to believe that the earnings per share are growing fast enough based on my expectations that that multiple is going to drop down to a market multiple or preferably below market multiple within 5 years. Both of these do it faster than that. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is based on this justified PE formula that Mobison has put out in the world, and I've tried to recreate it, I think that both of these companies, based on their returns on incremental invested capital, my expectations for their earnings growth, and the cost of capital that I'm using, basically the hurdle rate or required rate of return that I'm using, both of these companies, I think, deserve to trade at 25 to 30 times. So they're currently trading at fair value based on what I think a fair multiple is. And like I said, I'm willing to pay fair value. It's the second thing I'll say. Last thing I'll say, Ryan, is I spent a lot of time, and this was the first newsletter that you just referenced, I spent a lot of time thinking about that total shareholder return calculation. And that total shareholder return calculation says that your return from a stock is equal to the dividend yield, if it has one, plus earnings per share growth,
plus or minus the change in the PE ratio. So let's do that. Let's do this for Amphenol and Trane. Both of them pay a 1% dividend yield. Both have a 1% dividend yield. If, you know, let's say they both trade at 30 times right now. One trades at 30, one trades at 27, but just for, you know, to make it easy, let's just say that both trade at 30 times earnings. And let's say that over the next 10 years, that PE from 30 contracts down to 25. Remember, I think 25 is the low end of what I think their fair PE is. So let's say it contracts from 30 down to 25. Over 10 years, that's a 2% headwind to returns. 2% annualized, 2% per year. So now I also put both of these companies in my 10 to 15% earnings per share growth basket. I don't know whether they're going to grow. I can't, you know, precisely say 12% or 13%, but I have pretty darn high conviction. They're going to grow somewhere between 10 and 15% earnings per share. So let's say they grow at the low end, 10% per year. So now we can use that formula. 1% dividend yield plus 10% earnings per share growth minus that 2% headwind from PE multiple contraction. That gives you 9% total shareholder return. Let's say it can grow 15%. Okay. Now you have 1% dividend plus 15% growth minus the 2% headwind from PE multiple contraction. That gives you 14% annualized total shareholder returns. So 9% to 14%, you take an average, it's 12%. 12%. Base case shareholder return expectation for the next 10 years, 12%. Let's say, Ryan, so that's the first one, 12% expected annualized returns. Let's say the PE contracts worse from 30 all the way down to 22, which is the current market multiple. That's a 3% annualized headwinds to returns. So now, once again, we expect 10% growth after we factor in the 1% dividend yield and subtract the 3% headwind. That's 8% annualized total shareholder return. At 15% growth, we do that math and you get a 13% annualized total shareholder return. Once again, we take the average of 8 and 13 and we're at 11%. So in both of these scenarios, with pretty severe PE multiple contraction, in one scenario, I come up with 11% base case annualized shareholder returns, and the other scenario, 12%. Now, that may not sound very high, but I am underwriting the portfolio to 12% annualized returns. On average, I think the portfolio, based on my expectations, this is not what's going to happen. This is what I think is going to happen based on my analysis and my valuations. I think the portfolio in a base case could return 12% annualized in today's high valuation market. So in both of these cases I just explained, one case is 11%, one case is 12%. I'm really underwriting to like 12% annualized returns. And these are two of the highest multiple stocks in the portfolio. Two of the highest multiple stocks in the portfolio. Like I said, trading around 30 times earnings. And I still think, based on my analysis, they could provide me with 11 to 12% annualized in a base case. But these are companies that have historically surprised to the upside. Great businesses find ways to grow faster than you expect. And both of these have exceptional management teams, in my opinion. I would not be surprised if they end up returning 13% annualized or 14%. Once again, that's my promise. That's within the realm of possibilities for sure, based on the way I'm valuing these things. And if you look, you know, if I go to FinChat and I go to the overview page on Amphenol and Trane, both of them have grown over the past 5 and 10 years, their earnings per share at a mid-teens rate, like 13 to 15%. And I was just using 10% in one scenario here. Over the past 5 and 10 years, they've both grown annualized EPS mid-teens, 13 to 15%. So, you know, I try to leave myself the possibility for upside optionality. These are two of the highest multiple stocks in the portfolio, and I'm still underwriting them at fair value, which I think is about 12% annualized returns.
Okay, as we wrap things up here, John, if you could give one piece of advice to anyone entering the investment industry today, what would it be?
What? I'm going to give you three. you know, one is network as much as you can. Do it politely and don't be overbearing. Like, for example, some stranger reached out to me, probably an incredible person, but asking me for a recommendation for a financial. Well, I don't know this person, right? Like, I can't give them a recommendation. I'm more than happy to have a phone call with this person, have several phone calls or Zooms with this person, you know, hear them out, learn about them, teach them some things, share some lessons I've learned, talk to them about investing. More than happy. I do that all the time. But, you know, don't be overbearing about it. But network as much as you can in the investing industry. And as part of that one, write up as many one or two page thesis write-ups on stocks as you can, across industries, across sectors. Start off as a generalist. Learn about as many different businesses as you can. Write them up specifically, not a book report, not a history of the company, a thesis on why you think the company is undervalued, why you think the stock is going to go up, why you think and how you think you can make money in this stock. Write up as many of those as you can and share them with your network and try to learn from them. Take the feedback. Be coachable. Don't have an ego. Be coachable. Take the feedback and incorporate it and get better. Put in the reps. Do these write-ups. That's number one. Number two, read as much as you can. Don't let AI read for you. Use AI to become a more efficient analyst, but don't abuse it. And when you're, I guess, 2A or 2B or 3, I don't know. When you're doing these write-ups, whether it's thesis write-up and earnings write-up, don't let AI write for you. Be an independent thinker. Think on your own. Build the skill sets. Build the tools. Build the foundation. Build the muscle. Be coachable. Network. Put in the reps. Work harder than you think you have to, because you do. And be an independent thinker. Build your own conviction. Do not get ideas from X or newsletter. They can be a funnel for your ideas, but don't automatically make them your own. Be an independent thinker. Build your own thesis and your own conviction. Learn to do the work.
Okay, that's going to do it for today. Thank you all for tuning into this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. John, thank you for joining the show. If you're interested in more of his thoughts, the link will be in the podcast description. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Ryan, thank you. Thanks, everybody.